This is The Gould Standard, Episode 44, A.R. Rahman, The Complete Musician, Part 1.
Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Levine, and welcome to The Gould Standard. Today, we have the privilege of speaking to one of the truly universal musical artists of our time. A.R. Rahman is one of India's national cultural treasures. He is an incredibly prolific composer of film scores for both Tamil and Hindi cinema, and occasionally for Western films as well. But he's also a producer, a concert artist, songwriter, popular musician, and more recently a filmmaker who has ventured into the world of virtual reality. He has composed scores for over 225 films, and his live concerts draw tens of thousands. A concert he and his ensemble gave in Kuala Lumpur earlier this year drew 72,000 fans. He's the winner of just about every award imaginable, from Oscars and Grammys to the National Film Award, Filmfare Award, a BAFTA, and a Golden Globe. He's also a deeply spiritual man and artist, who has presented a vision of peace and harmony through his hugely successful concerts of Sufi music. And his universalism is also reflected in the way he seamlessly blends elements and styles from many musical cultures and traditions together. He was named one of the world's 100 most influential people by Time magazine, and on top of that, he is a dedicated philanthropist. Despite his superstar status, he remains a quiet, reflective, and modest man. So I hope you won't be too embarrassed when I say that for Western audiences, it is difficult to grasp the impact, influence, and reverence he inspires in his own country and beyond. We were very lucky to have him as a member of the Glenn Gould Prize jury in 2020, and we're equally honored to have him with us again. Rahman, sir, welcome to the Gould Standard.
Thank you so much. It's a great honor. Come
here. Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. Now, just to start us off, I'm always interested in people's origins, how their early life experiences affect their later paths in life and in their careers. And in your case, your father was a composer, R.K. Shekhar, a very distinguished and respected composer. And I understand that not only was he active in film scoring, just as you later would be, but that he was a real workaholic and that he was the kind of person who was dedicated continuously to his composition. But he also died when you were very young. You were, 9 years old?
Yeah, that's correct.
It must have been incredibly hard for you and your family. Can you describe what it was like afterwards, just trying to keep going?
Yeah, my early life was, as a kid, when I was 4 or 5, I used to accompany and take lunch for my father. The studios used to be around 20 minutes away from my house. So my mother used to, and then I used to accompany, I used to watch him conduct and arrange things for other people and his own work. And I think when I was 6 or 7, he fell ill. And the rest of those 2-3 years were a disaster, actually. Hospital after hospital, spiritual healing and this, every religion, they tried everything. And he almost like, when he died, he looks like Gollum. He looked like Gollum, like completely, you know, in a very bad shape. That's one of the reasons why I that memory kind of haunts me. And then the whole cremation thing and everything, you know, when I was 9. So to come out, then I joined the studios as a keyboard player because my father's friends wanted to encourage me and my mother felt like I should take over my father's profession. So I was a roadie. I used to set up equipments for other people when I was young because father had kept some equipments and my mom rented out those things, like the organ synthesizers and stuff.
Right, but I mean, had you had lessons? Like, were you already playing at the age of 9?
Yeah, I was actually learning the piano, harmonium, and then I resumed the lessons when I was 12, 13. Mm-hmm. And then I was also working. So when I would finish the weekends, I would go to Mr. Jacob John, learn classical piano. Then of course, I think life teaches you more. Life teaches you mm-hmm. what to do, what not to do. And you learn from working and say, okay, I like this and I don't want to do in my music, I don't want to do what they're doing. So mm-hmm. you learn this in the best university is life.
Yes, and getting exactly.
Into, yeah.
But you were a school-age child as well. So am I right that you were both working in the studio and then when you weren't working in the studio, you were in school as well?
I was, and I was to get all the kind of threats and abuses. In a way, like, you know, they any school they want. School is very strict here. Like, yeah. If you don't come, you don't get attendance. How would you, you know, that's the question. Mm-hmm. And it was difficult for us to explain to the school that
right.
The house has to be run.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you were the breadwinner for the family at this point, and that must have been very, very challenging for everyone.
Yeah, yeah. But then I think, when I think about it, it is a blessing. Not that I lost my father, but me getting into the, you know, nuts and bolts of music and production and film scoring at an early age. And maybe I would have worked in around 300 movies because those days, the scoring was just 3 days. You know, they held the whole orchestra and then we just get the notes and boom, boom, boom. 3 days, it'll be like 14 reels done. Next movie. And there would be no breaks at all, except for Sundays, yeah.
So, I mean, that's a tremendous training in discipline, in, you know, being productive with your time and all the rest. So the work that you were doing then, it was basically for film scoring.
Yeah, I was a session player. I was a session player. So I'd play keyboards. And then around 84 end, I'd saved up enough money. And then this thing came, like a music computer. Mm-hmm. From Yamaha, and I said, I need to get that. I remember it was $1,000, and it had FM synthesis and composing software, scoring software. It was very primitive. You mm-hmm. literally had, for one note, you had to enter like 6 commands, you know, gate time, velocity, timbre, and pitch. Yeah.
Has the world ever changed? I don't know if you know, but I always tell this story about how technology has changed yet. Before this, I was part of a record label that I co-founded, and we were always trying to advance the quality of the sound. So we were, I think, one of the first record labels, if not the first, to go from 16-bit to 20-bit recording. But we wanted to edit all of the recordings and keep them at 20 bits and never downsample it. But the problem was storage space, because a 20-bit file is much larger than 16 bits. And I still remember the day that one of our engineers broke in to my partner's office and said, there's a breakthrough. We can edit at full resolution now. There's a hard drive that's big enough to hold the files. It's 9 gigabytes, but it does cost, $12,000.
Oh, wow. Yes.
So yes, that was a different world.
Yeah. And then those huge hard drives, right? With the power supply, one gig. So you get, instead of getting 100, I'm like 10 MB floppies. You get a
yes.
Yeah, I remember that stuff.
It was terrible, but also wonderful. It just makes us realize how privileged we are now. When you were doing your session work, I mean, were you also beginning to become familiar with studio production techniques, running the equipment, or was that something that had to wait until you got your music computer?
What happened was we had this band out of all the studio musicians, like. There was a gentleman called Johnny who passed away. Then Sivamani and Raja and Jojo. We were kind of sick of studio work. Not sick of studio work. It was like tiring. Mm-hmm. And whenever we had time, we would jam and play stuff, which is create our own fusion work. Mm-hmm. And though we did just one concerts, you know, El Shankar, who was playing with Shakti, he came in and he said, I want a band. He had a band called The Epidemics with his wife Caroline that time, and he came and said that, why don't you guys back me up? And then he did a record, and I was there, I was watching a couple of engineers who came in and in awe, like what they were doing, like sampling and looping. And so that kind of was life changing, you know, the moment you see somebody else work in a different way, whereas we work like 3 days, you know, bang bang bang.
Yes.
And suddenly you see, they're doing a song for like a week and they're just changing it every day, shaping it, like sculpting it. Mm-hmm. So the possibilities of a song making completely changed. That, and then you read books, and then you read, you know, those days there's no YouTube, right?
Right.
So you literally to cycle and go to one bookstore like 45 minutes away, and I'll ask him, do you have this book, Music Maker or Keyboard Magazine, right? And we'll wait for 3 months, and then suddenly three issues will come together, like a jackpot. Then you read
right,
it.
Right, right.
No, I used to sleep. I used to read all the interviews and all the ads, and
yeah.
From then, yeah.
Right. And of course, like you turn the page and, oh my goodness, you can do that? You know,
yeah, exactly.
And suddenly, right, yeah. But interestingly, at around the same stage in your life, you went through a bit of a spiritual transformation as well when you embraced Sufism. And that must have been, you know, quite a dramatic moment in your life and for your family too. What led to that? And you know, because it seems to me from, you know, listening to your music and admiring your music that it's something that has been a very powerful influence on your musical path as well.
I think it was a very natural kind of a thing which happened. So my father, who was going through various spiritual treatments, we were hoping that something would save him. Towards the end of it, we went to a spiritual Sufi healer also. And he kind of predicted what's going to happen. My father was in pain, so he was not interested. He didn't have any faith in anything. So my mother, he treated my mother like a daughter. And he said, you are so blessed. And she could see many spiritual things in that place, the spiritual healing place. And he said, you're going to come back after 10 years. And by then, my father passed away. And then we never knew. We forgot about the whole thing. 10 years later, I was getting this equipment from, you know, Singapore. And I had a problem with the customs. And it got confiscated kind of thing. How did you bring it? We're not going to give it. You know, it was like whole. Indian customs were very strict that time. You know, it used to be 300% duty. If you buy $1,000, it's actually $3,000. Yeah, it's literally. And we were prepared to give that and they wouldn't give it. And for some reason. So that's when I think one of his patients, like one of his students, saw me and said, and he went and told him. Then his kind of student worked in the customs or something. So they helped clear it. And then we were very grateful. We went back to him. Is when he kind of, everything kind of collided. And then I started my studio and he blessed it and named it Panchatan. Panchatan is like five holy people of the faith. So connected to Sufism. So there was no, like nobody told us, oh, you have to come to this faith, nothing. I was just more peaceful. I felt like something special, like things were working out, you know. The jingles which were rejected, you know, after prayers would get accepted. All that stuff happened. And then I felt like, right now I felt like so liberated, having my own studio, sitting in a place, and there was a kind of empowerment, like as though I got my own kingdom, even though it was like a small room like this. And slowly, you know, I told my mother, we have to choose. We have to choose which side, you know. And she said, of course, we're going to choose. And then we moved from our old house to the new house, which I have studio now. And so that's a very organic thing. And then things kind of opened up. You know, we were more going to the Sufi shrines and studied. I was getting more interested in the more Gnostic, mystic kind of teachings. And I was fascinated. I was like, buy all the books. And what is this stuff? And it was so fascinating to see, because it's also an alien culture to Indian culture, right? It's pretty alien to Indian culture. We have, you know, the yoga, we have beautiful things. But something fascinated for me in that. And it's like you knock at a door and then you get an answer. And then you go towards the door, right? So, and strangely, even though there are different ideologies in the same thing, there's a singular thing, like you are equal to everyone. There's no superior, there's no white, black, and rich and poor, and this caste and that caste. So what I loved as the equality about, because we all feel intimidated at various stages of life, people put you down. And somewhere you felt empowered that, oh my God, there is something, which is how humanity should be. Everybody's equal, and we are only superior in our deeds, in our thoughts, in our ideals, and not by birth or, you know, by richness or economy and state and nation. So that fascinated me. And actually, that's one thought which made me become fearless about trying new things, fearless about charity, fearless about saying, yes, we'll do it. Let's see what happens.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. I mean, it sounds as though it was you know, a completely natural progression for you in your life and in your family's life, because it was your whole family that made the change. Was it, I mean, it also feels somewhat daring from a social point of view to embrace a different faith in, you know, a society that sometimes, you know, there's a history sometimes of, you know, religious strife in India, in different parts of India. And I don't know, but was there any kind of a social pressure that created a challenge for you in making this change in your life?
Actually, we didn't feel any kind of, nobody even asked about it. You know, they would come for the music, they'll have the food biryani.
Yeah.
And there's no such things, because the Indians mostly are very open people, mm-hmm. especially South. They're very open and they're very embracing, and they're happy people. They want everybody to live and let live. And that's what happened. Even now, I think the past few years have been like strange because of political stuff, but mm-hmm. we can see them, you know, they just look through the inner light, and they have the power to look at the inner light. So what's happened to your face? You look so bright. Or what happened to your face? You look dull. And you know exactly what they're looking straight to your heart. And not only just Indians. When I go, good people, they always see the light in other people.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's something that really strikes me about your music making and your concerts is that, you know, you bring together an audience that is from every possible faith and background. And they are all united by the music. And when you're performing your concerts of Sufi music, my sense is that, you know, you get an audience that is, you know, far from being just people who are in the Sufi faith, but from, you know, Hindus and, you know, other branches of Muslim faith and, you know, even Christians and Jews, that they all basically feel this sort of warmth and embrace of the music making that you create. And that feels like it's something that's very intentional in your music making.
True. I think the product of what you learn, like if somebody studies medicine,
yes,
the fruit of that is they're going to help humanity. I also feel that your faith or whatever you're learning and whatever you're experiencing, the fruit of that should manifest into good deeds. The fruit of that mm-hmm. should be, you know, the upliftment of humanity, to pulling up, you know, the poor and mm-hmm. do whatever you can, sharing knowledge or build things which humanity can, you know, like plant a tree. Nobody knows who planted a tree, but then you all enjoy the shade. And for me, my kids, that's my lesson to my thing. This is our family. My mother was like that. My wife was like that. I am like that. Mm-hmm. My kids are going to be like that. And they're already slowly, you know, realizing it. They're very inquisitive about how can we, you know, do better things? How can you?
Right.
It's not about gathering money. It's about mm-hmm. being happy and sharing what we have.
That's very beautiful. Well, let's get back to the practical elements of your career. I'm still trying to visualize what, you know, the scramble of, you know, trying to attend as much school as you could while, you know, being on call for these gigs. And, you know, basically, I mean, am I right in saying that you would sit down with a score that you hadn't seen before? You had to basically sight read it all, you know, you basically would get like one take or two takes of everything, you know, and then move on to the next cue. And, you know, it must have been a scramble, you know, financially and just in terms of keeping up, because, you know, childhood isn't always easy. It's a pressure. Did you manage to feel, were you worried a lot or were you under stress a lot, or did it just feel like natural?
I did have feelings of like, because the social structure is like, if you're not educated and nobody would give the girl to you, you can't get married. Mm-hmm. Oh, he doesn't have a job. Oh, there's still a stigma about the film industry.
Yeah.
And because the film industry is also admired the most and also been ridiculed and has stigmatized the most. Oh, he's from the film industry. He'll be drinking, he'll be taking drugs, he'll be debauchery and all this stuff. And then, so somewhere, I think because I have got three sisters and we moved away from the crowd and we set up the studio in the house, everybody was actually treated like a guest and almost like a sister, almost like a brother. Mm-hmm. And they were all connected with my family. You know, they would come to my house straight away. Any singer, they'll get food from my mother or have a coffee from my, you know. So this is the first home studio, right?
Right.
It didn't feel like a studio. They'll finish, they'll relax, they'll talk. If I'm sleeping, they'll go talk to my mother. come down, and then I'll have the session. And that's actually a luxury which I've enjoyed in my life. I think I should say that's one of the biggest luxuries. Because when you go to a studio, the meter is running, you know, and then you have to finish it. And then they say, oh, next client has come. Can you get out?
Right.
Or we had to close down. The security is going. Can you get out? I never like to stop my creativity. I want to go on. Like, it's a good thing and a bad thing because people think, oh, my God, he doesn't. I work from like evening 6 to morning 6 because I like the peace. The busyness of the city goes and then you're just peaceful.
Right.
And I think I have some of the most amazing people with me, human beings who always been assisting, who always cared and sympathized with my vision and helped me, you know, run this.
Yeah. And it reminds me of when you described the way you had developed your studio and the kind of home-like atmosphere that you were wanting to create. It reminds me of an experience I had many, many, many years ago when I was taken to a tiny restaurant in the mountains in the French Alps. And the owner of the restaurant came and he basically said to us, welcome to my home. He didn't say welcome to my establishment. He said, welcome to my home. It will be my pleasure to feed you this evening, you know? And so I think that that's kind of a spirit where the work and the life, basically, there's no artificial distinction between them. Now, the other thing that really strikes me as very curious is, you know, the way you describe the kind of music making that you were doing just to, you know, to help your family survive and, you know, then moving into your studio is that, you know, there was probably, I mean, my image is, you know, one kind of music that was kind of more or less a formula for the kinds of films that were being made. But in your own life and in your music making, you've become very well-versed in many different styles, you know, of the classical traditions, Carnatic music, you know, Hindustani music, as well as Western music, pop, rock, fusion, you know, jazz, you know, rap. You know, how did you begin, well, particularly within the family of Indian classical music, to develop that kind of breadth of reach, because the styles are so different between the North and the South, the Carnatic and the Hindustani.
Yeah, so Hindustani, Carnatic, it's there because it's there in the air. You play that and then you play a song, you learn the raga. So there's songs, film songs also based on raga based. But because there's so much into it, I always felt like I should not listen to that stuff. I should listen to what's happening around the world. So when I used to go to London or anywhere else, I would just go to the world music section and pick, you know, African and, you know, like Bali stuff. And so just curious about what's happening there. And that kind of helped me to imagine there's another sound there waiting. And if I play a taiko in an Indian style, it sounds Indian. And it doesn't have to be the taiko style, but the instrument can create an Indian kind of a sound with this, with a more spectrum of bass and all the stuff. So that, because of samples and because of my knowledge or whatever experience with the samplers, it was a very easy, I wouldn't even think twice to use a taiko in a classical song.
Right. And I've noticed that it's very interesting, you know, in terms of your treatment of certain kinds of rhythms and the use of, you know, different rhythmic instruments, you know, that it feels both, you know, an extension of what I think of as, you know, traditional Indian music, even pop Indian music or Bollywood music. But at the same time, it really feels very comfortably Indian in flavor, you know. So it's really kind of interesting the way you've managed to introduce those elements, but make them feel like they're natural extensions of the Indian, you know, character.
Yeah, I think what I figured out is people here are in a way naive and yet open. They don't, you know, kind of box you, oh, this guy is South Indian or North Indian.
Right.
So what's nice is like you can have a really jazz progression movement. We can do anything. But if you have an Indian language, thinking that, you know, it's telling a thought, hey, why are you looking at me like that? Simple. That becomes an Indian song. Because the lyric and the tune drives it. And they care about the backing. And you see that even in the 60s and 50s, people like Artie Berman, you know, they also got influenced, like MSV. They had jazz players from Goa, and they had done stuff like that to their capability with live instruments. So I said, why not? Why not upgrade that to today's stuff? And so you can have an amazing chord progression. Nobody's going to question you. Where did they learn that in this movie?
Right.
As long as the lyric is driving that. So that's a trick which I felt like I can get away with in even African music. But if it's got an Indian lyric and if it's catchy, I can just change the framework and that'll sound, that'll take us to a different kind of a zone. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. And now there's one other episode in your early educational experience that, that also fascinates me, which is your time going to Trinity College in London, where you became immersed in Western classical music, if I'm not mistaken. How did that come about? And what was it like? You know, did you feel like a bit of a fish out of water? Was it a culture shock to be in this kind of more formal?
So Trinity College of Music was kind of, there's a place called Music Musical, and it's one of the oldest shops which sells piano. And they the examiners used to come from London. So we learned from masters, teachers from Chennai, and then the examination used to be at Music Musical. So the certificates used to come from Trinity College. It's not that I went to London. So it was, education was in Chennai. And later they called me and gave me something like a thing, yeah.
Oh, okay. But then you were basically doing the Bach and the Beethoven and that sort of sort of thing as well. So, you know, that kind of explains why they sometimes call you the Mozart of Madras, which is,
You know, it's a very offensive title because Mozart fans was going to be, hey, why Mozart to this guy? I honestly, please don't call me that.
Okay, maybe, I won't. Now, there was another break in your early career because in 1987, you basically stepped away from film writing or from film music and became, you know, very focused on jingle writing, on the advertising aspect of music, which I take it was really a big sector and flourishing at the time. You know, why did you make that change? Was it something that you consciously did? Were you trying to make a break or...
So what happened was I got all this equipment, like the sampler, the microcomposer, vocoder, and all the stuff. And I finally cleared it from the customs. And I'd left my permanent job from a composer to come out. And my mom was like, why did you leave that job? It paid you. I said, no, I need to be free. I need to have time. I can't work like a slave continuously. And so one day, one of my young two music composers called me and said, oh, we love all the stuff you have. And they were paying me like four times more. So I said, no, I don't have to work that much. I just work for 3 days and I have 4 days off. So, and then this 4 days was taken away. Then I was getting into jingles when people came to, oh, you have time? Can you do a jingle? Scratches. So these scratches are actually the building blocks for my what I'm doing now. And here I met a very young crowd, away from the film, older crowd, which is very mature and, you know, they were catering to the masses. I met a whole international kind of a crowd where younger people, they would get me tapes from, you know, Latin America and Spain and France and all these commercials. And I said, oh my God, this is fantastic. And you told me about all the styles I'm doing. The basic foundation was from jingles because they would give me a jingle which is Latin oriented or bossa nova or a rap or classical. Now to have to replicate it. When you replicate it, you kind of study, analyze what's happening, what are the instrumentation, and it's just 20 seconds. And you kind of figure out, oh, this is it. If you have these instruments, you can get the style. So when I was doing the first movie, it was 20 seconds into whatever, add up to 4 minutes, 5 minutes. So my concentration on each section was, you know, articulate about. And then you realize, okay, you don't have to be like that. You can just autopilot and free run some of the stuff and change them.
And one thing about jingles is you don't have a lot of time, so you have to make your musical point very quickly. And catchy. I assume that to be catchy. So it basically gives you the concept of getting a hook, you know, and the sort of the negative version of that is the earworm, the thing that you can't get out of your head. Of course, in advertising, that really works because if people are going down the street, you know, whistling the tune for, you know, this chewing gum or that, you know, motor oil for the car, that means that you've basically succeeded in your work. And that presumably is very helpful when you're trying to do hit songs for just as Absolutely. A songwriter. Yeah.
I mean, that's the basics. That's the whole foundation of what happened in the 90s. So because of that, my focus was with every lyric, give me the hook, give me the hook. And then after a while, you felt like, enough of hooks. Let's go deeper into, you know, let's go into harmony change and let's go deeper. And my, I think, work from 2000, I think you'd see that I was trying to break away from it. And I was ready to sacrifice the success rate of that. Because I said, I've done that. I know that I can do that. I can come back to it. But I want to see, like, things like Zubeda or Lagan and all those stuff where, like, can I go deeper into music? Can I go, you know, can I write an orchestral piece, which is... Then I worked on, you know, Lord of the Rings musical on stage, which even more, it's very dark. It's a very dark musical.
Yes.
And with working with Matthew Watches and, you know, that, that actually was the most darkest thing I ever done.
And I want to get to that because it's something that, well, I will get to that because it's a very interesting episode in your career. But, you know, staying sort of more or less in sequence, the next sort of big turning point, I think, is the film Roja. And that's 1992. Was that your first complete film score?
Yeah. I think when in Roja came, like, I know I've shared this a thousand times. Suddenly there was a knock from India's biggest director, Mani Ratnam. And the whole country used to adore him. And everybody was like, everybody would throw anything to go and work with him.
Yes.
And so he comes in, and I didn't know that it was one of my client's brother, no, cousin brother. And she said, I was like, what? You never told me this. And so I was going for one of the parties where we won some prize, and then there was a party and he was there. And I invited him, like, said, can you come to my studio, listen to my stuff? And he was like, yeah, smile. And 6 months later, he was in my studio. And then I played him all the stuff I did other than movies and other than commercials, my experimental stuff. And he was quietly listening to everything. He came back and then rest was history, right? So.
Right, exactly. And it's a fascinating film as well. You know, it's a love story, but it's set amid kidnapping and terrorists and, you know, and a happy ending finally at the end. But, you know, that I think was... If I'm not mistaken, that's really when you start to be positioned as a serious film composer, where, you know, the person who did this film, you know, we want him for, you know, our film. And, you know, suddenly you're doing many, 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 many films. So I think, you know, the discipline of being able to work, you know, very efficiently and quickly must have really paid off when, you know, I can imagine people were, you know, sort of coming to you every week with a new film project.
So, yeah, so there's dichotomy there. Like, because I was doing films from childhood, like, mine was like, okay, let this be the last film and then let's go out, do an album.
Yes.
Let me cut off from the film industry, which should make you a slave and make you like a machine rather than an artist. So my thing was, how can I stretch this so that people don't come to me? How can I delay this stuff? How can I reject things so that I can say no? And it's the most toughest thing for Indians is to say no.
Right.
And because we don't want to offend people and we feel like, oh, that's come, it's given by God and why should we reject it?
Right.
And I think I managed it well in the, that whole decade, but then I kind of gave my diplomacy and and I said, okay, come, let me do it.
And right.
That's a good or bad thing, I don't know. But a lot of people wanted to work to me and like kind of fulfilling my word, I'll do it later.
Yeah.
I kind of did this in the past 2 years. I did all the tick mark and now I can go back to being like, no, I just want to do a few movies and do it
right,
me
exactly.
Well and do my private thing. Yeah.
And it must be, I mean, when you're in demand that way and people are coming to you, you know, it, I guess there's a question of like, do I only want to do films where, you know, like if I've seen the film, and I don't like it, I don't want to write the music for it. Did you ever find yourself in that situation? Like, I don't think this is a very good film, or I don't like the story, or I don't like the message.
I was not that. I didn't know how to pick music, actually. I for me, it's an experience with the director. Whether it's going the right way or wrong way, I would say add me in it and see what happens. And what can I do for the film? You know, people are looking forward to that name. What is AR going to do? What is AR going to do? So, Yeah. That kind of made me responsible. I never used to think, oh, there's a big movie, I should do well. There's a small movie, it might not run, so let me mess it up. It was never there. It's my name is there.
Right.
And I have to, there's a faith which people have. I have to keep that faith. I'd work my, yeah.
Right. So the calling of professionalism, you know, to basically maintain a standard that, so one of the things that also I think must be very interesting is, you know, the sort of, I'm sure that you were exposed to both, you know, lots and lots of Indian films, but some Western films as well. And the approach to film scoring, I think, is, you know, in many ways different. I mean, in Indian films, there, you know, songs have a very central role. You know, there are lots and lots of Western films in which there is no song at all, right? That's not just an expectation. It's all, I guess, what you'd call background music. You know, did you feel the, you know, sort of the influence of that, you know, both the Indian approach and the non-Indian approach in the work you were doing, you know, from seeing, you know, films from other parts of the world?
Yeah, definitely. I know that here you can, I was trying to gauge myself, like, where do I stand? And actually going to London, working with Andrew Lloyd Webber, hanging out in London, you know, going to all those museums and going get my own, you know, food and walking on the streets actually made me realize where I should go. Because I have a sense of adulation, which is, you know, unprecedented in India at that time. Like 10 years of, oh my God, whatever he touches is great and this and this and that. And then the other, there were like two people. The other people were like, oh, it's all BS. He's not going to last. He's going to be finished in 3 years. He's going to finish in 2 months. He's going to finish. And that parallelly was happening. But then I was thinking, like, where do I stand? You know, I was pretty clear because where I should be going. And then in 2000, actually, those trips to London and the world, you know, September 11th happened. And what is my karma? Why am I created? What is the objective of my being? All those things, like self-analysis came in. And then I realized, okay, I have a job to do. And it, through music, through, you know, people, good people around in India and the world, what can we do? Mm-hmm. Then I started my foundation. Then I started my conservatory where we're educating and kids with Western classical music, underprivileged kids, and then foundation, some amazing talent.
And I want to talk about the KM Academy because it really is an amazing project and a hugely, you know, important example that I think needs to be emulated in other parts of the world. But, you know, just going back again, you know, around the time that your film music career is exploding and you're becoming, you know, this, you know, enormously popular, enormously sought after, you're also now creating albums, and there are important albums, you know, albums from the films, but also, you know, like very, I would think, you know, something that really is an honor to do, like the, you know, Vande Mataram, you know, in 1997 for the 50th anniversary of independence in India. You know, that must have felt like a real responsibility, especially because, you know, it was connected with, you know, a non-Indian record company, which meant that it was going to travel to the world. Can you tell me a little bit about that project?
So what happened was one of the producers who used me for commercials, Bharat Bala, and, you know, so we met. Actually, we lost touch after I became a composer. I was like so swamped with work, I could never meet him. So I think 96, I met him and his wife in Bombay. And so he was saying, in my mind, I was like, I should do something other than movies, you know, I should not just depend on this. And because it'll be a good expression, and it's also makes the possibilities of music. So he said, why don't we do something for the 50th year of independence, India? And I said, yeah, let's try something. And then we got Mehboob, the lyricist, and then I'd done an album on Rangila and Bombay with him. So it was jamming, and then the whole concept of what Bharat Bala gave, like, for India, Vande Mataram, came in. And I said, this is my album. So the stuff which I'm going to put is my sensibilities, what I believe in. So there's Matru Jaisalam, the big song. Then there is the revival of the old Vande Mataram song. Then there is Gurus of Peace, because India and Pakistan both had 50th anniversary, right? So he said, why don't you work with Nusrat? Because he knows that I was a big fan of Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. It was the world music icon. And the other side had Only You, which is a very Sufi kind of a song, which talks about annihilation, fana, and how worshipping is not for something to gain something, but just for the sake of, you know, the purity of worship. And there was also Nafs Magroor Hai, which is a song about the bad will or said desire, how you just go against it to open the veils of, you know, purity in your heart. So that's one, another one. Yeah, so that whole album was very strange. Many things coming together. It's like destiny wanted us to do. We came together with Sony, who just signed me for the first time. They came in, they signed me for this album, and then suddenly the Sony Global liked it so much that they distributed all in the world.
And it became a big hit. And, you know, it's fascinating, though, that something that, you know, on one level would be seen as a patriotic statement is also such a personal spiritual statement. And, you know, the thing that I read, which I find very, very hard to imagine, is that Sony had actually suggested Celine Dion to be a guest artist on the album. Is that actually true?
Celine was just coming up and her name was not even there in the radar. And Sony said, we have this new artist. Do you want to work with her? And then I heard Celine and said, I don't find any song which resonates with this. You know, she's a great singer. Yeah. It didn't resonate for this album.
Yes.
And so we kind of declined the offer. But of course, I met Celine and her husband when I was performing for the 127th at the Oscars.
Yes.
I met both of them. He was very kind.
Yeah. And it's not a question of the caliber of the artist, but whether they're the right fit for this particular sensibility and project. One of the things that I really admire about you is that you're always exploring. You're always looking for new things. And some of that is in the collaborations that you've done. You know, for example, you know, working with Danny Boyle on Slumdog Millionaire, even though it's an Indian subject, it, you know, he is, you know, obviously an Irish director. The work that you did on Bombay Dreams with Andrew Lloyd Webber. And also, as you mentioned, Lord of the Rings, which, you know, because the book itself, the trilogy is actually, you're right, very dark. It has very, very, you know, but it also is, you know, sort of the timeless battle of good and evil, you know, the great quest. You know, there are many themes that really resonate across every possible culture in that work. But, you know, and in listening to the music, I've been really struck at how beautifully you have adapted to the subject matter, both with, you know, the show for Andrew Lloyd Webber and Lord of the Rings, and yet still remained true to yourself and your own artistic, you know, character. And sometimes these things, when you are taking those chances, work out well and are very successful, which Bombay Dreams was. And sometimes, you know, I'm sorry to say that it was, you know, an experience in my hometown of Toronto that, you know, Lord of the Rings didn't end up being such a big success, which is a pity. You know, tell me a little bit about, you know, taking those big leaps into completely different worlds, working for, you know, the London West End Theatre and, you know, doing Broadway types of things. You know, did that feel comfortable, or was it a real, you know, I don't know if I can do this, but I'm going to try, you know?
I think what happened was, I had this call from Shekhar Kapoor. Shekhar's movie Bandit Queen screened, I think, in 94, and I was watched it and I was blown away. Mm-hmm. Then we became friends. He wanted to do something with me. It never happened. One day, I think 99, he called me. He said, hey, I'm with somebody very important. I said, who? He said, Andrew Lloyd Webber. And I just bought Phantom of the Opera a year back, and I was listening to the CD, and I was like, oh, wow. He said, he's the king of theater and he wants you. And he's never, you know, used another composer for his musicals. Of course, he's a composer. He's produced his own musicals. So the first time, he was the most kindest man. And even now when he talks about me, he's so kind. So the whole thing was, I'm an introvert. I work in this little room.
Yes.
And I teach through playing on the keyboard, whereas theta is completely opposite. You need to sing, you need to be loud, and you need to be like express yourself, and you can't have inhibitions. I was completely the opposite. And so this whole ice breaking or whatever, metamorphosis of going into something else, happened in Bombay Dreams. And it was successful. In a lot of the rings, I think what happened was, even though people loved the stuff, what came in and what was spent was more than what came in. So unfortunately, it couldn't sustain that grandiose production, even though we're all proud of what we achieved on stage. Yeah,
right. And it was an enormous production. You know, do you think the fact that the films had come out not that long before, hurt the success? And also, you know, I did a podcast with Howard Shore, who wrote that music, and that was obviously a very successful score. Do you think that those are factors that got in the way of the play?
Could be
achieving?
Could be, because even though we never used any of the film's score or anything, it's all fresh.
Yes.
It was trying to, I think sometimes some of the stuff need, if you cramp too much into it, I think I feel emotionally you're not able to take so much. I think it was too much was cramped. Like the movie I did, PS 1 and 2, there are two parts. So you could enjoy, I think a body, biologically, you can only take some certain things if you're crammed with too much of things.
Yes.
That's what I think happened. You're trying to cram too much in one.
Right.
There's so many sub-stories and so much material to.
And I do have to say that, you know, three novels that are 1,000 pages long, that's pretty hard to get into one evening in the theater.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's too much.
Yeah.
Please look out for part two of this episode coming soon. The Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to keep bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca, and follow us across social media at the Glenn Gould Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of The Gould Standard. Fire.